So this is the talk number 3 from the Cloud Mountain retreat this April. And we'll see how this talk goes, because just now, and the reason I'm a little bit late is the computer down in the lodge was frozen, so I have no notes. I've often wondered how that would be. However, Mark's down there trying to save me, because he is an IT guy, so maybe he'll save me. But nevertheless, I want to talk tonight. It's sort of like the other side of what I was talking about last night, the ways we struggle. I want to talk about the all the different aspects, well, lots of the different aspects of happiness that are inherent in practice. What happens, how it brings light and life and joy and ease to our lives. In spite of the fact that what we get to look at and see are all those things, all those little, you know, ways we have. But the healing process itself and how it manifests, it's just absolutely essential to remember. And I was slightly triggered, not triggered, but it made me really want to talk about this, was because one of you today was talking about, well, if I could describe my kind of practice, then it would be called grim earnestness. When we laugh, it's because we can relate, right? And I certainly can relate to this. And for a long time, I was so grim. You know, I think there's something, as I said at the time, there's something so sweet and lovely about earnestness. And even when it's grim earnestness, it's still, it's far out. I mean, you know, without a certain amount of earnestness, then nothing's ever going to change. So it's a very wholesome thing, but it can get a bit much, that grim bit. So we need to balance the struggling with the relief. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. So here's a quote. This is from Sri Ramana Maharshi, Advaita master from the last century. If the mind is happy, not only the body, but the whole world will be happy. So one must find out how to become happy oneself. Wanting to transform the world without discovering one's true self is like trying to cover the whole world with leather to avoid the pain of walking on stones and thorns. It's much simpler to wear shoes. Thank you so much. Genius. Great genius. What would we do without Marx? So, we would like the world to be a happy place. And the fact of the matter is that we make it all up in a kind of way. So when we're in a certain mood, that's how the world is, right? When we're in another mood, that's how the world is. We can't change the world, but we can change ourselves. And so let's put shoes on. Mm-hmm. And these are one of the most essential ways of doing it. This is Albert Einstein. From the age of 6 to 14, I took violin lessons. I guess you didn't know he was a violinist. He took violin lessons but had no luck with my teachers, for whom music didn't transcend mechanical practicing. I really began to learn only after I had fallen in love with Mozart's sonatas. The attempt to reproduce their singular grace compelled me to improve my technique, I believe. I believe on the whole that love is a better teacher than a sense of duty. Mm-hmm. Grimm has a flavor of duty instead of a flavor of love. Earnestness can have a flavor of love and a flavor of duty, but it gets too into the duty side when it becomes grim. And another quote, Saint Teresa of Avila. After deep contemplation, she She doesn't use the word meditation, but I'm sure that's what she's saying. We begin to lose our craving for things of the earth. And no wonder, because one sees clearly that no riches, no power, no honors, no pleasures can for a moment, even for the twinkling of an eye, give such true joy. The inner delight, light, that comes from an inner life is just, there is nothing to compare. I really have the image of all of us. I mean, I have an image of us being little mice in wheels, you know, running in their cages, or of dogs turning in circles, chasing their tails. But I have this other image a lot of us, like dogs barking up the wrong tree. Like we're really trying to be happy. All the things we do, even the most, you know, mean things we do to ourselves, as you know, is we're really trying to find, you know, pleasure and happiness and solution. We just are going about it the wrong way. We're going barking up the wrong tree. And we're just so fortunate. Once we start looking at the right tree, we start to find the things we really think we're wanting, which really aren't quite there in the wrong tree. So, I was wanting to talk about this since yesterday, and it's been burbling around in my mind, which is the way I prepare my talks. I do them at the time, you know, whatever it feels like the right thing to say. And so, luckily or funnily, about an hour ago, I just thought I'd check back to see what I said last year at this retreat. I gave this talk last year. Who was here last year at the retreat? Okay, only four or five of you. Well, pretend it's the first time you're here. It won't be the same, but it's the same kind of topic. I suppose a four-day retreat, you know, this has to be one of the topics. So I want to talk about the values of the heart, the inspiration. We use the word fruits of practice, meaning what happens as we practice, that they develop fruit. They ripen because of practice. But fruit is a thing that you eat, that nourishes you. So fruit, it's a good word because it's both a result and a fuel. So it's a chicken and an egg scenario. Both, you know, we need the fruit to keep going, and we keep going, and there comes the fruit. So it's, you know, they both grow together, as it were. So both a natural response, an organic response, is, as I said, for example, in speaking this morning, somewhere in our Q&A session, I think it was, and I was saying, we don't take ourselves so seriously. We're able to laugh at ourselves and forgive ourselves, and we're kind of dear with all of our little silly ways, you know, we're trying so hard. That lightness is a natural fruit, so it's a result of practice. But we can deliberately foster these kindnesses, which is why we practice metta, for instance, so we can be fostering and helping encourage the natural fruits of practice. So, I'll talk both about the tools of practice, that, you know, the uses of these things, and the and them in their result form. One thing to bear in mind is, I said this to somebody today, whatever we do, we're practicing doing it. Whatever that may be, and so we're getting better. If you think of everything you do as practice, then every time you're irritated, it's getting better, getting stronger, getting more in there. Every time you're down on yourself, it's getting more established. Every time you forgive yourself, that's getting more established. It just is, it's how it works. And the instructions that we give and how we are attempting to practice, the real instructions are to practice in such a way that we're practicing free behavior, wholesome behavior. Even though, however, we give those instructions, we receive those instructions, we don't practice that way quite often. We don't practice We didn't ever say, be grim, for instance. Freedom is freedom from grimness, is freedom from judgment. But we tend to practice with expectation, with disappointment, with the things that aren't free characteristics at all. We need to practice being the free one, the happy one, the kind one, the spacious, steady one that we are wanting as a fruit. We can't practice grimly for ease. What we want as a fruit is various versions of calm, clear, spacious, equanimity, steadiness, connected, understanding. And that's how we have to be doing all of the things we're doing. So we really need to keep that an eye on the manner with which we do what we do. It's true for most of us that the initial impulse to practice, and why many of us have come to practice, are starting to look inside, is because of some thing that's unhappy, some form of unhappiness, some heartbreak, some pain, some frustration, some difficulty in life that the other way hasn't worked with. That's usually the impulse for many of us. Not always, but it's common. And that's true, and it's necessary. It's also, as I said yesterday, when we feel the cost on our system of doing the same old agenda, we learn not to do that. That's all true as well. It's not that I'm negating that in what I want to talk about today. But there's also the inspiration. There's also deep in us this knowing what we would like and how we'd like to be, that we can draw on. Which is why in the very beginning of any formal period, and it's why I like in the morning to do that chant, it's like refuges. That's the whole point. It's like, not just as some formal thing that they've done for thousands of years, but what it for you, can it be food? Can it cheer you? Can it encourage you? Can it inspire you? Yes, I do want to wake up and be as clear as possible and see what's really going on, and stop kidding myself. And stop playing games and staying all superficial and hollow. I want to really be real. I want to really connect with people deeply, honestly, kindly. Refuge in the Sangha. These are beautiful things. They're beautiful things. Mm. They're not hindrances and problems. They're beautiful. And so let the beauty be what encourages us. So one of the phrases the Buddha uses is gladdening the heart. Mm-hmm. I quite like that. Mm-hmm. The glad heart. Here's some words that he says about a glad heart. These are two different descriptions of the same progress that happens. Here, the Buddha is talking to his attendant, who's his first cousin, Ananda, who was his attendant for many, many years with him. He says, for one who is abiding, that means sitting, right, staying, contemplating the body as the body, a bodily object arises, or a bodily distress. A bodily object meaning an itch or a cough or a, you know, something. Or a bodily distress. Or mental sluggishness that scatters his mind outward. Anybody had your mind scattered outward today? When the mind is directed to... then the monk should, well, just pretend that's you, should direct his mind to some satisfactory image. When the mind is directed to some satisfactory image, happiness is born. From this happiness, joy is then born. With a joyful mind, the body relaxes. A relaxed body feels content, and the mind of one content becomes concentrated. He then reflects, the purpose for which I directed my mind has been accomplished. So now I shall withdraw directed attention from that image. He withdraws and no longer thinks upon or thinks about this particular image. And he understands, I'm not thinking upon or thinking about anything. Inwardly mindful, I am content. That's a description of directed meditation, he describes it, meaning you deliberately call up something, metta, yourself as a little kid, you cheer yourself up, you calm yourself down, your mind settles and calms down, and then you can go back to the breath. Whatever is to be done by a teacher, oh, this is just an extra thing that I could say at the end, but I'll say it now, as it's on the same page. Whatever is to be done by a teacher with compassion for the welfare of students, that has been done by me out of compassion for you. Here are the roots of trees. Here are empty places. Get down and meditate. Don't be lazy. Don't become one who is later remorseful. This is my instruction to you. But don't be grim. Don't be lazy, but don't be grim. So here's another thing he says. When someone, a monk, you know, because of those days, when he is given up, renounced, let go, abandoned, and relinquished the defilements, desire, ill will or aversion, agitation and worry, sloth and torpor, dullness, doubt. When we have given up, renounced, let go, abandoned, and relinquished these, we know, I am endowed with unwavering confidence in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha. And we gain enthusiasm for the goal, enthusiasm for the Dharma. We gain gladness connected with the Dharma. The Dharma, of course, means the truth. We're glad about the truth. When we're gladdened, joy is born in us. Being joyous in mind, the body becomes tranquil. The body being tranquil, we feel happiness. And the mind of those who are happy becomes concentrated. It's just the same steps, the same thing. And while I'm on the subject of the steps, some of you know, just a reminder that it's all the same teaching, some of you know the seven factors of awakening. Mindfulness, which leads to interest, wonder, which leads to enthusiasm, which leads to rapture, delight, which leads to serenity, which leads to concentration, samadhi, which leads to equanimity, calm, steady, balanced wisdom. Seven steps, it's the same thing. Now, my practice for a long time was the grim, earnest student, and it went mindfulness, interest, virya, energy, enthusiasm, and more energy and enthusiasm and effort, and more effort and enthusiasm, and more effort and enthusiasm, and then concentration, eventually. And then concentration to equanimity. Nowadays it goes mindfulness, interest, enthusiasm, rapture, serenity, concentration, equanimity, way more easily, because it includes delight, joy, happiness, serenity. Because it's easily convinced this is great. Instead of like, I must. Somewhere, there's something I should. It's already satisfied. It's already content. When my heart is gladdened, it just is content to settle down. It doesn't settle down because I'm nailing it down. I may have told some of you this, but I often say this. I remember very clearly a phase of practice. This happens from time to time anyway, but it was really strong at one phase where I would be, particularly I remember doing this in walking meditation, but it's the same walking or sitting, trying to make my mind stay, 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 And then it would think a thought. And the image would be like a white, big white bird flying off. Mm-hmm. And so then my mind would grab that white bird and nail it down. No, it would say. Stay. It did stay eventually. But it was, you know, pretty tiring. Ute Janir, the teacher who I was sitting with, I've mentioned a few times in Burma, he says, you know, if at the end of the day of meditation, if you're at all tired, then you've been doing it too hard. So we learn, you know, but it's like anything, when you're a young person learning or a new student at anything, we usually overdo the trying. You know, we're really trying hard. It's very sweet. We're sincere. We're earnest. We want to ride the bicycle and we don't want to fall off, and so we're clutching the thing. You know? So tiring. I've started playing the saxophone. It's very, you know, my mouth and my hands have to unclaw. They're now unclawing. They're now a little more fluid with it. But we just do that. We try hard. When we can bring to ourselves remembering and experiencing and reminding ourselves of the good qualities, the beautiful qualities, which I'm going to list and we'll explore a bit, we're so reassured, we so relax. For instance, one of the things I was saying yesterday, you know, we were talking about the hindrances, that hindrance doubt. When we don't doubt, we try hard, and then we continue to, the more we doubt, the more we try. And when we don't doubt, when we trust, we relax. It's okay. It's okay. Relax. And then the mind is easily present, because it wants to be present. It's very soon learning that being absent and spinning around in confusion and storytelling and drama, whatever the flavor of that, and often that's painful, is costly. Isn't so pleasant. So let's think of some of the aspects of an inner life which are food, fruit, nourishment, which grow. And you'll have all tasted all of them to some degree or another. So there's, and these come from time to time, and sometimes we can remind ourselves. So there's just the, for instance, the lightness of heart. Sometimes it comes as an insight, a flash. It's like, oh, this is delightful. Or we see something and we're delighted by it. We walk around and, you know, the colors of green, the beautiful mosses, the sweet little... We're all so happy to see the raccoons. They aren't when we're home and we're paranoid that they're going to raid the, you know, garbage can, and, you know, but somehow when we're doing an inner contemplative time and we're calmed down a bit, they're kind of cute. There was a very, very big maple right in front here to the right of the big bamboo and that the lawn that was just mown. You can see the huge stump with the big boles on it. It was huge, bigger than the one that's still there on the left. And it had a family of raccoons. Year after year, they would nest there. And the babies would all come out and sit along on the branches and peer down, and they'd come down sometimes. It was a very great entertainment for yogis on retreat. We would love these raccoons, you know, especially the baby raccoons. So those kinds of things, we see how delight is available to us easily when our mind is more calm, more clear, more quiet, lightness of heart. And we're friendly. You don't see normal people walking slowly down a driveway and carefully lifting worms out of the way. But we do that kind of thing. You know, we've made an agreement at the beginning of our retreat that we're not going to harm life, and we take it to great lengths. You know, we're really very... there's a sweetness. Mm-hmm. Then there's the, these are just sort of random, not in any particular order, of the qualities of the heart that come up from having an inner reflective time. There's that feeling of enthusiasm. It's like, this is interesting. This is good. There's a very wholesome energy where we apply ourselves. And it's a discipline, but it's an ability we have. And to actually get keen about something. We get up early in the morning. I mean, part of it is that you're told to and somebody's waking you up with a loud bell. But then everyone else is there, so you feel you should, and the teacher said you should. But there comes time when you want to. And the word, the Buddha used this word tons all through the, you know, volumes and volumes of the teachings of the Buddha. He used this word virya. It's often translated as effort, but it's many translations, courage or in courage. Courage from the cur, the word heart. You know, take heart. One of my favorite translations is by this Englishman who I like his writing a lot, Stephen Batchelor. He uses the word enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. At times, I mean, we don't always feel dead keen to do it, you know, it's like, okay, another sit. But at times we feel enthusiastic. We want to be here. We want to see. As we see and we understand, we get to enjoy it. It gets interesting. The helpfulness that happens, the being able to realize how this all works and what I've been doing and hanging myself up, it's inspiring. We become enthused. Has anybody experienced that so far this retreat? Quite a few of you. It's not there all the time, so be wary. Don't get, you know, don't judge yourself because you haven't been enthusiastic. It's not consistent, but it's strong. Along with that is along with it, very close part of it is that feeling of delight. It's a kind of, this is neat stuff. One of the hazards, I'm jumping ahead a day and a half, one of the hazards of leaving a retreat and going and being with people who've not been here is that we want to share our delight of the process with people who haven't experienced it, and they are not so delighted. They're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Great, sounds really fun. But we know it's better to not try and share it with them. Unless they really, really interested and they keep asking, then you can, but don't wait. Otherwise, it's actually a shame because they don't share our enthusiasm and then we doubt ourselves, you know. But the inner, that you know, there's some delight in being with our inner selves. Really, we like ourselves a lot more than shopping and other things. I mean, we do. When we get right down to it, once we get over some of the things that are difficult about ourselves and we've learned to tolerate that, you know, we're such a critic or whatever, it really gets interesting to see how I am, who I am. I'm really interested in myself, let's face it. So there's, you know, there's some delight that happens in the practice from time to time. Then there is a beautiful quality that comes with this practice. This is the fact that the practice is revealing the truth, the Dharma. By being with ourselves, we face what's actually going on. And increasingly we get to be with the truth. The truth of who I am, the truth of how we are, and that there's something so utterly satisfying. We actually want the truth. When we're younger, we don't want the truth, you know, so we don't even tell little children the truth because we don't want to put them off. But really, we do want to know. And there's something so satisfying when we find that we understand. And even if it's something that's really a difficult thing, like grief, for instance, there's a sweetness in the grief when we can completely face it. When we can finally really face something, even the most difficult things, there's a flavor that, I don't know what the flavor is, I think sweet's the word that I use, that we can accept, it's acceptable, because we know it's true. There's a kind of settling that happens. Oh, I see. There's some relief, isn't there? Mm-hmm. When we get to the bottom of something. Mm-hmm. That's not available when we're skittering around trying to make it be okay or, you know? There's this very profound satisfaction, contentment. it's trustworthy, the truth is trustworthy, we can relax with the truth. Once we really get it, oh, that's what was going on. That makes sense. When it's with someone's behavior, you don't know why they did what they did or they said what they did, and you have a conversation and you understand, oh, I see, that's why you said that. Okay. Well, it wasn't very nice for me, but I understand. We go quiet. When we haven't got to the bottom of something and we don't quite know what's going on, we're churning, what's happening, you know, we're worrying with things. But when we can finally get it out, there's a beauty there, there's a wholesomeness there, there's goodness there. And so along with that is, then I can trust. There's trusting. Trusting and truth are so similar. When I trust a process, or I trust what somebody said, or I trust myself, there's confidence, there's calm, we can proceed. It's when we don't trust, because we don't know what the truth is, that we're hesitant, we're anxious, we're second-guessing. When there's the truth revealed and we can trust something, or we trust somebody and they have integrity and we know what they say is what it is, because we know them enough, it's okay, we can carry on, as it were. It's not a hang-up, we're not stuck. It's freeing, isn't it? Liberating. So this kind of quality of confidence. For me, myself, I have so much confidence in being present and seeing and all of these things that come from doing this practice for my own life. But as you either know or would imagine, having now witnessed people many, many times over the last 7 years sharing with me how it's working for them, for you, I have like 10,000 times as much confidence in it, because I just, it's again and again, I see all these little ways people are healed, in lots of little ways. It's not everybody's awakened. Few of you are arahants in here, maybe. But the way it just, oh, something makes sense, I understand something, oh, it's beautiful. Well, you don't have that great opportunity that I have, but I just mention it to you because it's happening all the time in every retreat, this retreat. People healing, learning things, understanding things. It brings such confidence in the process. And then it's easier to do it. Okay, I don't get hung up. Should I do this? What should I do now? I'll do it, you know. It's good. That's a beautiful characteristic, a joy of practice. Then there's another joy of practice, and that is the calm. Now, you know, we don't all get the calm, and we don't all have the calm. Some of the time it's accessible, some of the times it's not. Some people are churning, or they may have something going on in their lives that's disquieting anyway. But one of the aspects of meditation, as the mind does settle down, is it gets calm and gets tranquil. And there is such a nourishment for the spirit when we can finally relax and finally the mind can settle down. For those moments when it can, it's so satisfying. My first really deep experience on a long retreat, I did deep concentration practice. I did jhana practice for some months. And when the mind was so quiet, in deep concentration, it gets really quiet. Not a flicker of a thought for long periods of time. It's amazing, it's perfectly possible. But when that happens, the image that I still retain, funnily enough, and I haven't been deeply absorbed for a couple of years, I haven't done that practice. Year and a half. Is, I picture, it's funny, that my cells all drinking. It's like, oh. It's like being a dry sponge that's sort of like softening and expanding, and oh. There's such a relief to be able to be still in the mind. Almost everything we want, we think we want the thing, But what we really want is peace from the wanting. We think that peace will come by getting the thing. We think it's about the thing. We think it's even about the wanting. It's actually a satisfaction of the wanting, so there is no more wanting. And in that moment when we're thoroughly satisfied, and we've known those moments in different ways in our lives, oh, that's really what we're looking for, not the thing that leads to it. We forget that. That deep quiet, when we have ease, still, calm, in meditation, tranquility, pasadi, the Pali word, it allows the mind to settle and see clearly. So it's a step on the way to understanding. But that piece of the journey in itself is so nourishing. It's all the word I can think of. It just feeds the spirit. It feeds this, like, oh, I love this stuff. A lot of people go into meditation for that. That's what they want. That's what they think meditation is. It's calm. It's unstressing, which it is. Not to diminish it by any means. It's profoundly valuable. It's not the ultimate freedom that's possible through deepest insight, but it's a huge piece of the nourishment as we go. The body relaxes, the shoulders go down, there's no more frowning, you don't get tired. You can sit for a long time completely comfortably. The angst in the body that's got all kinds of tensions and pains disappear. There's no need to do anything, you don't have to get up. Everything's, this is enough, it's deep satisfaction, deep, deep contentment, it's beautiful. It's part of having an inner life, part of meditation. From time to time. And then another on my list of qualities and things that are accessible is the love, is the connection. This happens to in all different ways for different people, but I remember for myself when it shifted, I've mentioned this on this retreat even, when it shifted in me from being self-concerned, which is, I mean, I like myself, I'm interested in it, you know, so I'd be interested and delighted in discovering how I function. But some point, it began to open up. My consciousness began to open up. And it wasn't then just about me, it was about us. It's about how we are, what it's like to be us with these minds and these hearts. And suddenly there was room in my energy field to be able to relate, to have compassion. That's one of the things that happens. We start off, definitely, it's about me and my story and my pain and my struggles and how can I heal my needs and anxieties. Absolutely, it's necessary. But over time, especially when you've visited your needs and your things for, you know, 1,000 times or whatever, it begins to be, you know, it's like, wow, this isn't just me. And often people will say in retreats, they realize that, you know, all these people sitting around me, this person I know is going through their stuff and this one their stuff. This one has their story. So the ability then to connect. I was telling somebody in a small group, I think it was today. Or was it all of you? I was talking about the airplane today. It was in that metta this afternoon I was mentioning. There was a woman who did metta for she was doing 6 weeks of metta on the retreat that I was just teaching in California. Did I not say that to the whole group? Mm-hmm. I said it to a small group this afternoon. So she was doing a lot of metta all through the month of February, continuously, nothing but metta, all day, all day, many hours a day, all through February and into March. And in March, I was a teacher, and the team of teachers changes from one month to the next, so I was in a second month. And so she had this month already. And then partway into her second month doing, she started metta right towards the very end. This is just a little silly thing, but it never happened to her before, and it's never happened to me for sure. An airplane flew over because it's on the flight path for planes coming in, depending on the weather, coming in from the north down into San Francisco International Airport. So they come down over Marin and then over the Golden Gate and then into the airport. And so she looked up, there was a plane coming over. And instead of it being a plane, she looked up and she thought, oh my goodness, there's more than 200 people and they've all got lives and they're all going to meet people and they're all going off on trips or leaving people they love. She suddenly, it was a whole new bunch of people to be interested in and care about. Right, just flying overhead. And we don't usually perceive that way, but the heart can, and it begins to be connected. We do with the slugs and we do with the raccoons, but we start doing it with, you know, people around us. It sort of naturally starts happening. It's beautiful. It's hugely beautiful because that's part of why we do it. We do it so that we can be connected and have compassion and understand each other, and we find we do. This is one of the things, backtracking to the truth, talking about truthfulness and the value of truth and it feels good. This is an interesting reflection. You could never apologize unless there's been truth. It takes some truth first and then you can apologize. And when somebody apologizes to you because the truth is now out and they've apologized, you can forgive. We can't forgive without the truth. We can't apologize without the truth. We can't reconcile without the truth. We can't even solve problems properly unless it's the truth. You can't say, I'm sorry, until you've said, this is what happened, and I'm sorry. It's a sweet thing to be able to say you're sorry. One of the words you've heard me use, which I really like, in doing what we're doing, we're getting closer to what's really going on, closer to the truth. So the word I like is intimacy. And intimacy is all about truth. That's what intimacy is. You can only have an intimate relationship when somebody's really vulnerable and open and truthful. That's what it means. That's a very beautiful thing. That is, you're becoming intimate with yourself. You're getting close to and understanding yourself, familiar. Then another thing that comes within an inner world, an inner life, spiritual practice, is we start to not just joy, you know, or loving people and connecting and getting to understand. All these things happen. We get delight and enthusiastic, we calm down. We get to see so much more beauty. We get to appreciate things. We're instead of living more with the glass half empty, we tend to live more with the glass half full. We tend to see the good. We appreciate. We feel more grateful. It just is part of the fruit of it. It's a beautiful thing. We realize deep inside, I think, that we have a choice. We can grumble on, you know, or we can actually appreciate the silver lining in things. And we find ourselves doing more of that. We can encourage ourselves to do that. I have a good friend who has little stickers around her house. Look for the good, look for the good, look for the good. Which is a great practice. But we start seeing the good, it's what we do. I don't know if I've mentioned it here. I think it was in Portland just before I came here, but I know some people who have a little club. This is just a half a dozen of them or something, and there's a little club, and they're mudita mentors to each other. And they do a little email every day, some kind of thing that cheered them up, that they're happy about, that they want to share with their friends. Like, they do a regular email cheering up kind of thing. It's a sweet thing, like some lovely thing. I mean, we all do it to some degree. Somebody says, oh, get this, you'll love this email, you know. But some people make that a habit. They deliberately foster that. It's a sweet thing. Some people, this is a good idea, know, this is smart, they know who they can call on who will cheer them up, and they call on them sometimes. Like when you need a lift, you know who to, it's like your resources. Like when you're hungry, there's some people who are really cheerful. Have them on your list and phone them up. It's just clever. Because some people are more optimistic, or they are able to see the bigger picture or whatever. Count your blessings. I hadn't put this on my list of things, but it just popped into my mind. There is this tendency, some of us have more than others, to love the sacred and to make things a little special. You know, at Spirit Rock, who's here been to Spirit Rock Meditation Center? A few of you have. You know, in the meditation hall there, big beautiful hall with the altar at the front with the Buddha and the Buddha's mother, two statues there and some flowers. But on the back, there's another altar with a Kuan Yin figure of compassion, which is just left as a little side altar, which gets covered up every retreat with all kinds of treasures, large numbers of photographs of people that people love, but little flowers and little feathers and the sweet things that we honor. A lot of people love little treasures, little sacred things. There's something about the sacred, a sacred space, keeping a place together and clean. That whole delicate piece comes forward when we have a practice. The care with which we place things. I lived with a man once for a number of years who was not a practitioner. And one of the things that we talked about, he was a messy kind of person when it came to house stuff. And so he was cluttered. Stuff was everywhere. He was always losing stuff. And I'm the other. I'm much more meticulous and particular about where I put things. And so we had a conversation about this one day, and I said, when I put something somewhere deliberately, apart from the fact that I know where it is because I deliberately put it there and I don't lose it, he said, oh, that's a good idea. I was like, I put it somewhere, and when I actually put it there, it's not just that I'm being, you know, fussy about it. It's that I care for that thing and I want it to be balanced or something like that. There's a degree of caring about it that makes me do that with care. Then I can find it again, but I actually like it when I put it there. And he could never imagine, so he never thought of putting something down because there's something special about it. It didn't change him. But in the moment, he was intrigued, and to me it was obvious, but it was interesting, and I remember it because he was surprised. And it was something about like placing something with a little specialness. I have a friend who does that, I mean, to great, you know, ultimate extent. She's a Virgo, every picture has to be just so. Colors, combinations, beautiful. I find that very pleasant to be around. I like the aesthetic. But it's not just aesthetic for itself. There's something special about that. That's part of having an inner life also. It's a beautiful thing. Another thing that comes from having an inner life is our conscience. We tune more acutely into, of course, we're tuning more acutely into everything internal, more sensitive, but our cringe factor gets more sensitized. So we're more, we feel worse when we've done something that we shouldn't, we've put our foot in it, or we've, you know, blown it in some way, we really don't like that. And we're more careful that we don't do that, which means that we increasingly live with what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. And that's a very beautiful state, to not have remorse because we've been more careful. Instead of being, you know, going off like a loose cannon and being out of control and reactive and not bothering, and then at the end of the day, oh my God, we don't have that. That's a very, very special thing. In fact, it's so important that the Buddha taught that we need to consciously be discerning and decent in our behavior all day so that we can have an inner life. Because if we don't take care of that part, then we're going to be sitting there feeling remorse all the time, and then we can't relax and get on with being concentrated. We need to have peace from having care in how we behave, which is also why we do the precepts in the morning. And it's a good thing to have, like guidelines, because they protect us. To have that conscience that pricks. There are these two words, hiri and otapa. H-I-R-I, OTTAPA, Hiri and Otapa, translated as moral shame and moral dread. I know I say that rather moralistically, and I don't like moral, the word even. It's way too puritanical and Victorian for my way of thinking. But the meaning of it is that conscience that doesn't want to shrink, doesn't want to do something and feel bad. Moral shame is when we've done something and we wish we hadn't. And moral dread is when we haven't done it quite and we're like, uh-oh. The Buddha called them the guardians of the world. I was talking to somebody this afternoon about this very thing. The guardians of the world. If we did not have those, even though they're pricking and not so comfortable to feel, if we didn't have them, we would not be very nice people. We'd be dangerous. We'd be going around, as some people don't have a very acute sense of that. And they hurt people all over the place, stomp on people's feelings. They're beautiful. They grow with an inner life. And then metta itself, of course, all the different aspects of metta. Forgiveness, the making friends with. We want to be friendly. We can actually practice being friendly. We can make room for anything, even the most awful hindrance attack. We can actually say, oh, this is hard. And have a soft, spacious, warm, friendly, make room for ourselves, for what happens. It's a whole talk, a whole meta talk. I'm not going to go into it at this time, but I wrote down here, blessed relief. I think that's probably, for me, one of the most important fruits of practicing, is over and over and over a feeling of blessed relief. It's relief, it's the opposite of struggle. When the struggle subsides, what a relief it is. It's blessed. Inner peacefulness, inner calm, not argument, not contending with, not against life, not wishing it were different, but an inner calm. It's the most beautiful thing, the most clear fruit of practicing for me. Another one is that I laugh more and I'm funnier than I ever used to be and I don't take myself so seriously, and that's great. But it's inconsistent, it's just once in a while here and there. But there's a constancy of quiet inside that never was there. That was only there in moments, that's way more established. That's a blessed relief. The way of love, a few quotes to end with, from Rumi, the way of love is not a subtle argument. The door there is devastation. Birds make great sky circles of their freedom. How do they learn it? They fall, and falling they're given wings. It isn't all fun, but it's so profound and deep, we get so strong. Here are some love poems. Hafiz. Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, love me. Of course you don't do this out loud, or otherwise someone would call the cops. Still though, think about this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye, that's always saying, with that sweet moon language, what every other eye in this world is dying to hear. Why not? This is Meister Eckhart. All day long a little burro labors, sometimes with heavy loads on her back, sometimes just with worries about things that bother only burros. And worries, as we know, can be more exhausting than physical labor. Once in a while, a kind monk comes to her stable and brings a pear. But more than that, he looks into the burro's eyes, touches her ears, and for a few seconds, The burrow is free and even seems to laugh, because love does that. Love frees. St. John of the Cross. It's called If You Love. You might quiet the world for a second if you pray. And if you love, if you really love, our guns will wilt. And I don't know who said this, but I'll end with this. A single atom of the sweetness of wisdom in a man's heart is better than 1,000 pavilions in paradise. A single atom of the sweetness of wisdom in our hearts, better than 1,000 pavilions in paradise, wherever paradise is. This is all, it's all here. All these lovely words and all these beautiful states, they're all accessible easily. We all know them. These are the riches of having an inner life. They're really what we want. And they're all, we can have them. And we do. Don't miss them. These are all my way of cheering you on. Let's sit quietly for just a couple of minutes.